So today we'll pick up where we left off and finish up our discussion of instantons. Finish discussing the vacuum of two-dimensional E1 gauge theory, and then I'll briefly discuss how our discussion of U1 gauge theory in two dimensions changes when we go to non-abelian gauge theory in four dimensions. So the story will be very similar, and you already explored some aspects of the four-dimensional non-abelian instantons in the tutorial yesterday. And then in the second part of lecture, we'll change topics and move on to something different, namely anomalies, which are quantum effects that can spoil classical symmetries. Okay, so where we left off on Monday is we had a set of standard maps, U nu of theta, that mapped the boundary at infinity in two-dimensional Euclidean space, R2, to the group U1. And these maps just took the form e to the I nu theta. And so these maps wind around the circle U1 nu times. So nu is the winding number. And in tutorial yesterday, you saw a perhaps somewhat mysterious formula for the winding number. And in fact, given a general map, we can recover the winding number. So I just wanted to explain how that works in the U1 case, and then I'll argue that the story is very similar, although the derivations are a little bit more involved in the four-dimensional non-abelian case. So in this two-dimensional U1 case, so here we're studying U1 gauge theory. On R2, it's easy, not very difficult to construct a formula that returns nu from a map like this. So in particular, we want to take a derivative if we want to bring down a factor of nu, and so we can write down a formula that gives us back nu from a map that works for these cases, these standard maps. It just takes this form, so we want a derivative of u inverse, and then you can multiply by u to cancel off the e to the I theta. And if we just plug in our standard maps, it's straightforward to see that we recover nu, which is what we want. So we just get e to the I nu theta minus I nu theta e to the minus I nu theta. These cancel off. The minus I cancels with the I, and this integral cancels off the 2 pi. So this gives us nu like we want. So at least this is a way we can recover the winding number from the standard maps. But in fact, this formula works more generally. And so the way to see that is I can argue that if we continuously deform one of these maps, we're not going to change the winding number. The only way we can change the winding number is by doing something discontinuous to our map. If we do a continuous change, the winding number as given by this formula is invariant. And we can show that. So to see that, if we take u to u plus delta u, u, the integrand, u d theta of u inverse, goes to u d theta of u inverse, plus we get a term where the first u varies. So that gives us a delta u d theta u inverse. We also get a term where u inverse varies. And so that's the derivative. And the variation of u inverse is just u inverse times the variation of u inverse. And if we just expand this out, calculate the derivatives, the first term is simple as we can make it. We'll get three terms here, one of which will just cancel off this term when the derivative acts on the last u inverse. So we're left with two terms, both of which are negative. When the derivative acts on the first, same u inverse here, acts on the first u inverse, or when it acts on the variation of u. And the u inverse in that case will cancel. Left with d theta delta u inverse. And we can write this as minus, so we can combine these two terms. In this term, the u and the u inverse cancel. We're dealing with an abelian gauge theory here, so those cancel. These two terms can be written together as a total derivative, the derivative of u inverse of u. And so this transforms to itself plus a total derivative. And what we're interested in is the change in the integral of this. So that total derivative term will vanish upon integration. So that this tells us that the winding number is invariant. And also shows that because this winding number is invariant under continuous deformations, it also tells us that we can't deform pure gauge configurations that have different winding number into each other continuously. So this new characterizes the homotopy classes in this case. So that tells us that our since our pure gauge field configurations correspond to solutions with minimum energy, this tells us that there's a barrier between those classical zero energy field configurations. If we want to deform one into another, we need to pass through something that's not pure gauge. Another key property of these maps is that they're additive. So I can construct a map with winding number nu by multiplying together two maps with winding number nu1 and nu2. And it's clear from the explicit form we have for the standard maps that this map will have winding number nu equals nu1 plus nu2. So instanton configurations will have non-trivial winding number, and they'll be able to change or tunnel from, allow the field to tunnel from one of the classical zero energy configurations to another by this property. And there's one other useful formula we can write down for the winding number. So here we've written it in terms of these maps U. but it's sometimes convenient to work in terms of the field, gauge field, or field strength directly. So let's rewrite our expression for the winding number in terms of the field strength. So since the formula we just derived, and we can write this, the limit r goes to infinity of I times the integral 0 to 2 pi of r d theta over 2 pi a theta. Because this expression here is just the angular component of the gauge field. If we're working in cylindrical coordinates. And well, we can rewrite this in another way.
Sorry, where did the r and the integrand come from?
Well, so we know that our gauge field looks like if it's a pure gauge field configuration, it's A mu is U dd mu U.
Yeah.
But we've gone to cylindrical coordinates. So dd mu should have units. Dd theta doesn't. So that R is just to make the units consistent. So we can also, so we can rewrite this in a following form. So here I'm going to introduce a radial unit vector. And the two-dimensional Levi-Civita tensor symbol. So because r hat is in the r direction and this epsilon just picks out the perpendicular or the other component of a mu, the angular component, a theta. So that's just the same thing as the line before. And well, we can write this integral on the boundary as a volume integral. So just we'll get an extra derivative here, epsilon mu, nu, a mu. And so this is to be written in another form. So we can write this just in terms of f mu nu. So f mu nu is just, this should be a nu. It's just dA minus dA with the indices reversed. So we get this. We have the same terms here as we do here. This 2 just counts to the fact we've got 2 of them. And so we can write the winding number in terms of the field strength. And in fact, this integrand is going to be of interest to us in the next thing next topic we talk about. This integrand here will turn out to be the chiral anomaly. In 2D.
Yes. How do we get from the first line to the second line? I'm just wondering where this A dropped out of.
Where?
Oh, yeah.
This?
We had used the previous line, and now we have A, so just kind of, where did that come from?
Where did this?
No, second, from the first line
to the second line.
Yeah.
So I just used that A mu is u, at least for r goes to infinity, is u d mu u inverse, and changed to cylindrical coordinates. And so the perhaps mysterious formula you use into your tutorial for the winding number is essentially just the four-dimensional generalization of this. So in the four-dimensional case, the analog of this formula involves the field strength and the dual field strength. Okay, so things are very similar for non-abelian gauge theory. In R4, four-dimensional Euclidean space. So I'm not going to go through things in as much detail as I just did, but the derivations have a very similar character. So I just want to make a few comments on what the differences are. So the simplest non-abelian gauge theory we can consider is SU2 gauge theory. And so for SU2 gauge theory, the U's, which were just functions in the U1 case, now become matrices. So you can write a element of SU2 as e to the I, have some coefficients. It's a Pauli matrices over 2. This can be written in another way. We can rewrite this as some coefficient A times the identity matrix, times some I times some other coefficient bi times sigma I for A and bi real. If we look at the Taylor series of this expression, we'll get each term will be the product of some number of sigma matrices. So that will either give us a sigma matrix or the identity matrix. So we can write an element of SU2 in this way. And from this formula, we see that if we want U to be unitary, then we should have that A squared plus BI, BI is 1. And this is just the equation for a 3-sphere. So when we go to SU2 theory in 4 dimensions, the story is very similar to what we were doing before for U1 theory in 2 dimensions. The big difference is that instead of looking for maps from the circle to the circle, from the boundary of R2 to the group U1, what we're looking for are maps from the boundary of R4, which is just the 3-sphere. To the 3-sphere, which is SU2, and this is R4 at infinity.
Yes, if we were considering U1 in R4, would we be looking for maps from S3 to S1?
That's right. And so, like before, there are a set of standard maps, U nu, that only depend on the angles. So the x here is x over the absolute value of x. And these standard maps take the following form. These maps, in a sense, wind the 3-sphere around the 3-sphere new times, just like before. And there are analogous formulas to the two useful formulas for the winding number that I explained in the U1 case. So we can write the winding number either in terms of these maps. So given a map, we can calculate the winding number just by computing the following integral. It's a bit uglier, so I'm not going to go through the derivation, but it's the idea is essentially the same as we did in the U1 case. The algebra is more complicated. The result is this. We just have to take derivatives of U inverse and multiply by U. Take a trace. So this is the analog of the formula up there. I'm not going to prove it, but the idea is the same. You could just plug in this explicit formula in here and it'll recover new. And can also be written in terms of the field strength. And this is the formula that you saw in tutorial yesterday. And again, the logic behind going from this formula to this formula is very similar to the U1 case, where we derived the relationship between the winding number and the field strength in two dimensions. The algebra is more involved. I'm not going to go through that. But it's the same idea. And again, as we'll see next week, the integrand here is the chiral anomaly. So there is this relationship between instantons that we've been studying for the past 2 weeks and anomalies, which will be the study of our focus next week and the later part of today.
I have a question.
Yes.
So in the 2D U1 case, you had to the homotopy of the circle, right?
That's right.
The homotopy as group. And so now here, we will have, can you see that the homotopy of that group of maps as the homotopy of a manifold, of some manifold? Because it's not the homotopy of S3, right?
This is, if you're familiar with this, so this is pi 3 of S. So we're looking at pi 3 of S3. So that's another way of saying that we're looking for homotopy classes here. And what this turns out to be the group Z, just like, okay. Is this familiar?
Yeah, yeah. Notation? It's just that I got confused because the one that is trivial is a pi 1 of S3.
That's right.
Okay.
So here we're looking at pi 3. I apologize for those who are not familiar with this notation. We're not going to use it even further. This is just saying that homotopy classes of maps from this 3-sphere to the 3-sphere can be characterized by an integer, the winding number, just like the homotopy classes of maps from the circle to the circle can be characterized by an integer, the winding number. That's what this equation means. I won't use this notation further. Okay, so that's how things work for SU2 and 4D. Well, there are other cases of interest. So one other natural question to ask is what? How would the story change if we considered a different group instead of SU2? There are two cases. One is we could consider an abelian group in D equals 4. And in that case, we'd be looking for the homotopy classes of maps from the 3-sphere to the circle. And it turns out those maps are all continuously deformable to one another. So there's no analog of the winding number for U1 theory in D equals 4. And so the other natural question to ask is what would change if we considered a different non-abelian gauge theory instead of SU2 theory. And in that case, almost nothing changes. There is a theorem that says that any map from S3 to some simple non-abelian gauge group, Lie group G, can be continuously deformed to a map from a SU2 subgroup onto a SU2 subgroup G. And so that tells us that if we replace SU2 by any other non-abelian gauge group, there still are homotopy classes that are characterized by an integer, the winding number. So the story doesn't change very much if we're considering another non-abelian gauge group. So what does this tell us about the vacuum structure of non-abelian gauge theory in 4 dimensions? Well, so you constructed instantons in, or at least verified some of their properties of instantons in 4 dimensions and for the SU2 gauge theory in tutorial. And so the instanton you constructed can mediate tunneling from a classical zero energy, classical minimum energy gauge field configuration with winding number m to some other classical minimum energy gauge field configuration with winding number n. And that tunneling rate should just be in the semi-classical approximation, just given by the saddle point approximation to the functional integral. Of this path integral. And only instantons that have winding number nu will contribute. Just like when we were studying the periodic potential, if you were interested in tunneling from the periodic potential, we were interested in tunneling from one vacuum to another. We needed to impose only configurations of instantons that went from our initial vacuum to our final vacuum would contribute. The same thing is true here. And so this is saying the instantons are the leading contribution to this functional integral. And this equation is telling us that instantons can change the winding number. And just like in the periodic potential, the energy eigenstates are not the classical minima, but superpositions of them. And well, so we've just seen that the tunneling can take us from one vacuum to another, or one sector of the gauge theory to another sector with different winding numbers. So those, our Euclidean time evolution takes us from one to the other, so those can't be energy eigenstates. And so the this expectation value, so this is not an energy eigenstate, even if these states are orthogonal, these states can evolve into each other. And this amplitude should be something like n minus n prime times s1, where this is the action of the nu equals 1 instanton that you studied yesterday. So these are not energy eigenstates. Instead, the energy eigenstates will be superposition of the n states. And to see that these are energy eigenstates, easiest thing to do is compute this amplitude, which, using the definition, is just given by this expression. Just plug in the definition of theta. And rewrite this. We know how these tunnel to one another, so we know what this amplitude should be. All right, just up to some factors. It should be be proportional to e to the minus the instanton action. And shift our summation variable. To be n prime minus n. And now the n prime factors out. And we see that this first factor is just n prime theta, assuming that the n and n prime are orthonormal. That if we just put a n prime over here, it will just pick out the n prime equals n term here. And so then this here has to be e theta. So these are energy eigenstates. We act with H on theta. We get e theta times theta. So these are energy eigenstates. And well, one natural question that comes up is how far does this, or we can ask how far can we push this analogy with the periodic potential? So in the periodic potential, the classically degenerate ground states became a continuum once we quantized the theory. The instantons led to a splitting, but the splitting was continuous. And so we can ask the question in the non-abelian gauge theory, the same thing happened. Are these different vacua part of the same theory or not? In other words, is there a gap? Or is this telling us that there's a continuum of excitations above the ground state, or is there a gap? And so what we can compute is the amplitude for some theta vacuum to evolve into another theta vacuum. So I've just used the relationship between the theta vacua and the N and M vacua. The states with a definite winding number. And I can rewrite this in the following way. So we know that this amplitude is related to the path integral. Functional integral, where the gauge fields, only the gauge fields with a certain winding number contribute. So we can rewrite this amplitude as sum over nu integral dA nu e to the I nu theta e to the minus s of a. And it also changed one of my summation variables from m to nu, which is just n minus m minus n.
How come the factor front, like how come the theta prime and minus theta and the factor front are the same coefficient there?
So I've written here m equals n plus nu. Here. So that are the sign rates. Okay, and so this sum is just a delta function. So this is telling us that the different theta vacua do not communicate with one another. So in a sense, they belong to different theories. And what we're left with over here, this factor over here, so we've got a restricted functional integral where we're just integrating over gauge field configurations of the particular winding number. But then we're summing over that winding number. So we can rewrite that just as a integral over all gauge field configurations. And what we've got left over as the integrand is e to the minus s, which is exactly what we expected. But then we also have this e to the I nu theta term. And we can rewrite nu in terms of the gauge field strength. That's the two-dimensional version, but the four-dimensional analog up here. And so this is suggesting is that the path integral we should be considering is not just the integral over the action, but we should add this extra term. So we can think about choosing a particular theta vacuum is in a sense equivalent to choosing the coefficient of this extra term in the action, which we could have added. This term is renormalizable. It's gauge invariant, at least if we restrict to gauge transformations that preserve the winding number. And it's renormalizable. So this is a perfectly reasonable term we could have added to our action to begin with. And these arguments are suggesting that we should. We're essentially, this is something we should consider when we're considering non-abelian gauge theory. This is a parameter of our theory. And I'm not going to have enough time to discuss a lot what the physical interpretation of this parameter is. I'll come back to it a little bit at the end of next week, but what I can say, just based on looking at this term, we can say that this term violates both P and CP. So if we do a parity transformation, taking x to minus x, because of this epsilon term, we'll end up getting this term won't be invariant. We'll get an odd number of minus signs because we have this epsilon symbol. And so this term can lead to parity and CP violation. And so it does have experimental consequences, at least in the presence of matter, massive fermions. And this is one, so at least for the SU3, for gluons, the gluon field, and the SU3 gauge group of the standard model, this is one of the parameters of the standard model that does have observable consequences. For those of you who took the standard model course, we didn't talk very much about this parameter. Not because it doesn't, in principle, have observable consequences, but just the experiments turn out to constrain the analog of this parameter in QCD to be less than about 10 to the minus 10. So we haven't seen any effects of this kind of type of term, but it's in principle, it is a parameter of the standard model that could have observable consequences. So that's basically concludes what I wanted to say about instantons. And next we'll turn to anomalies, unless there are any further questions on this topic.
So at theta equals to zero and pi, you should preserve time reversal.
That's right. Theta equals pi can have some more time reversal, right? Yes. So theta equals a pi is a special choice of theta that can have some interesting consequences. So that's zero and pi are the two interesting values here. Maybe.
We started this calculation wondering if the vacuum are continuously connected. So is this the point here just to say that you can't move from one?
You can't move from one to another. So we should think about different values of theta as different theories. So right there's no overlap between these two states. So they can't time evolve. Into one. Katie?
So that means it's gapped.
It's gapped. So one other point I should make that was mentioned on the tutorial, but I'm not sure if everyone got to the last part. So what I've presented here is a semi-classical analysis. So we're assuming that the dilute gas approximation works. That can actually be somewhat problematic in this case. There is a instantons have a zero mode corresponding to changing the size of the instantons, and or at least at leading order, it's a zero mode. So arbitrarily large instantons, you might worry, could contribute, and that calls into question the dilute gas approximation. You can go beyond that and make most of what I told you make sense, but there is a lot more to the story that I haven't explained in this case, just because of unlike the scalar field theory case here, we have to worry about large instantons, which if we have sufficiently large instantons, then even a small number of them will overlap.
What do you mean by the size of the instantons?
So the solution you've in tutorial you found was that A mu was U D mu U inverse times rho squared over rho squared plus lambda squared. So here rho is the radial coordinate, and lambda here is a parameter that parametrizes the size of the instant time. So for rho much greater than rho naught, this just approaches a pure gauge configuration. For rho much less than lambda, this just goes to zero, so it goes to a trivial gauge field configuration. So the solution you found essentially interpolates between the winding number zero and winding number one, if you choose this to be the map that gives winding number one. And where the transition happens is determined by this size, and this size can be anything.
Theory around any of these vacuum, you should obtain the same spectrum.
No, these will be different theories that will have different physics. And how to see exactly what that new physics is not a short story. But one thing you might worry about is changing the value of theta changes the coefficient of this term, which you might expect changes the amount of P or CP violation, because this term violates P or CP. So at least in the presence of massive fermions, like, these will be different theories of which will have different physics.
Okay. So what experiments tell us is that we live in a world where this theta take is really small, right?
It's really small, and that's a puzzle. Well, there's some possible explanations, but it's parameters not been observed. So we're going to change gears, talk about something seemingly different, although, as I've alluded to, there are some connections between the two topics. So the topic for the remainder of today and all next week will be anomalies, which are quantum effects that spoil classical symmetries. So throughout the year, we spent a lot of time discussing Noether's theorem. David told you about it in the classical mechanics course. It's something we also used in QFT1, and probably many other courses as well. So it's a very important and result in field theory. And so what I'm about to tell you is that Noether's theorem is a lie, but it doesn't always work. It's not what we're going to see over the course of the next few lectures is that we should really think about Noether's theorem as a classical result. So of course, it works classically. And sometimes quantum mechanically. So what we're going to try to understand is how and when this can fail. So this is clearly an important topic because we've used Noether's theorem over and over again in a variety of different courses. Symmetries are a powerful tool for understanding how physical systems behave. So what we're going to try to do is understand how and when can identify a symmetry of classical theory, it will fail to be a symmetry of the quantum theory. So you've seen, Jaume told you a little bit about this at the beginning of this course. For those of you who took the standard model, we also discussed anomalies in a little bit of detail. What I hope to tell you should be complementary to what you've already seen. So we're going to focus on the path integral derivation. And in the path integral derivation, there's a very simple way to understand when Noether's theorem can fail. And the failure can be traced to a non-invariance of the measure of the functional integral. And so we'll see why that's the case and how we can compute what the right-hand side of the divergent equation will be. So Noether's theorem tells us that there's a conserved current, which is zero. And what we're going to find is that in many cases when it fails, this is not equal to zero. But whatever is on the right-hand side is the anomaly. So instead of being able to derive conservation equations, we'll derive anomalous non-conservation equations. So we'll be able to determine how a would-be conserved current, what its divergence looks like. And so anomalies are physical, have physical effects that can be observed in the IR. One example is the decay of the neutral pion to two photons. For those of you who took the standard model, this is a decay that's forbidden by symmetry. But it is observed in nature. And the symmetry that forbids this will turn out to be an anomalous symmetry. And in fact, you can compute this decay rate entirely just by computing the anomaly. So there are physical effects that we can see in the and have been observed in IR physics. But they also have UV aspects. So we can, another way to think about them is they arise when it is impossible to find a UV regulator that respects all the symmetries. Often happen in cases we'll look at is we'll find a clash between some global symmetry that it would be nice if it was a symmetry and a gauge symmetry, which is more fundamental to constructing the theory and is more important. So if we have to choose between global symmetry and a gauge symmetry, we're going to choose to define our theory in a way that preserves our gauge symmetry. So this conflict between different symmetries is something we'll see come up when we compute these anomalies next week. And so what we're going to do next week is first we will study in some more detail massless QED in 2D. So this is a topic you looked at a little bit in your first homework in this course. This is one of the simplest theories in which there is an anomaly, and we'll be able to get some nice physical picture of what's going on. This is a great toy theory, so the mathematical structure of the theory is much simpler than many other theories of interest. So we'll do that, look at that theory on Monday. And then on Thursday, we'll do a path or functional integral derivation of the chiral anomaly. In a four-dimensional theory. So there we will, on Thursday, we will see how we can compute how the measure changes. We have an anomalous symmetry, so, and how that will tell us about what the right-hand side of this anomalous non-conservation equation should be. So that's where we're going. There, any questions? Okay, I'll see you next week.